I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. In this episode, the stars get lost in the country in Downton Abbey, and Daddy gets lost in the stars in Ad Astra. Plus, we get into the James Gray areas of space travel with the film's director. I'm Jake Cunningham, and joining me to set sail on this new odyssey, choosing to go to the moon and beyond, we have the shooting star of feminist film programming, Steph Watts.
Hello.
We have our Mars, our Mercury, our Milky Way, our Mark Towers.
Hi.
And the conversational black hole himself, Sam Howlett.
Hello. Thanks.
How are we doing?
Very good.
Yeah. I mean, in the words of Incubus, it's been a while. It's been 2 weeks, but it's nice to be back and to be talking about these two films with you. I hope it was Incubus that sung that. Was it?
No one knows the answer to that.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on that. Sounds
it's stained. Right. It was not. Oh, sorry, all you.
Oh, that's so embarrassing.
You stained fans out there. I'm just an Incubus boy at heart. Right. So we've got a couple of films to talk about before we get to the outer limits of the solar system and perhaps mainstream blockbuster filmmaking itself. We must start pretty much in the complete opposite direction on all counts, a film adaptation of a popular TV show about living in a country manor. Steph, you were cordially invited to the Abbey.
I was.
I'll just give a quick synopsis on this one before we dive into all the drama, the galactic levels of it. Can you imagine? It's 1927. The jazz age is in full swing.
No.
I know. And they're anticipating a visit from none other than the king and queen. The relatives, the servants, the inhabitants, they all swing into action. But can the silver be polished in time? There's only one way to find out. And that's to watch Downton Abbey, the movie. And Steph, you've done that.
I mean, high drama. You wouldn't see the king in space, would you?
That's so true. Yeah, the king has famously never gone to space.
I mean, I have watched the series. I can't remember if I watched all of series 6 because I think it kind of tailed off a little bit for me. But I was like weirdly excited to go and see the movie, like just being back with all those characters. I can't remember when it last actually aired on TV. It feels like it's been quite a long time. And you get the kind of not the TV opening, obviously, to the film, but you still get the big Downton Abbey title, and it's like, oh, I'm just going to watch 2 hours of this TV show now on a big screen, which won me over a little bit, I must say.
Does it literally just feel like an episode of the show?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
You still have like the similar kind of score, which is used in the TV show, which is probably pretty recognisable to a lot of people. It just kind of does its thing, really. Once you kind of get over the thought that you're in the movie version, it is basically a long TV episode.
But that's what it needs to be, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like that's the purpose of Downton Abbey, the movie.
Yeah, definitely.
Like it's not like people like they've got some like auteur director to come in and really whip it into shape with some like fresh new takes on polishing silver. But there's some ambitious stuff, and there's some surprising stuff from a narrative standpoint that people may not expect of what is an adaptation of a like Sunday afternoon drama.
Yeah, I think you definitely have all the stuff of kind of, oh, I can't find my dress in time for the party and stuff like that, which yeah,
we've all been there.
We've all had those. We can relate. And but yeah, you have the kind of, I think where the real interest lies is kind of in the basement where all the servants are with all the staff, and there you're kind of more normal people that you can relate to. So you have one of the characters is a Republican, doesn't believe in the King and Queen. So she's having a bit of a rough time because obviously the King and Queen are visiting. There's a gay subplot, which is like quite interesting, I think. And yeah, I didn't expect that to come through in the movie. I expected it to be all very kind of nice and pleasant and not really trying to tackle anything. Yeah, and there's a couple of characters, like there's one of the characters that basically used to be a servant but then married into the family, and he had like a really interesting narrative throughout the TV show of this kind of, where do I actually fit? I'm not like working class anymore, but I'm not part of this huge kind of upper class family. Where do I actually find my place? And he has a little bit more of a story development in the film as well, which I think actually slots in quite nicely.
So it sounds like it's maybe like swinging for the fences a bit more so than perhaps the TV show would, from like the story ambitions in this, like using that extended runtime to actually take the characters a bit deeper and a bit further than they have been before.
Yeah, I think, I guess it feels deeper because they put a lot of that into kind of a 100-minute runtime, whereas some of those storylines have been playing out in the show, but obviously it's over 6 series, so it does feel like a lot longer. And then you just have these characters' stories like running quite deep in such a short runtime, which, yeah, makes it feel a lot deeper and a lot more progressive, I guess, than some of the rest of the TV show.
Yeah. Do you think it's going to win anyone over that had previously not seen the show, or do you think this is like over the line into just for the fans? Do it for the fans, not the critics.
It does feel like a do it for the fans one. Like I would like to see somebody who hasn't watched any of the show just watch it and see how it goes. Because I think it is quite funny, and there's lots of humour that you could get without having seen the rest of the show. But I think there are some bits that you definitely appreciate more. And I think my appreciation of it came definitely from the fact that I've seen all of the show. I don't know.
Do they do any kind of character setup for people who are coming in fresh?
Yeah, I guess there's a little bit of like, oh, and you remember we had that baby 2 years ago and stuff like that.
That's so, what I've been looking for.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that stuff. So I think you'd have to. I mean, I was struggling a little bit with like Matthew Good's in this movie, but who was he in the show? I can't remember. And then when he like hops out of a car at some point, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember who he is now. But I think if you hadn't seen the show, you'd be like, who? Why is he here? What's happening? Type thing. So.
Well, I look forward to the next entry in the Marvel Cinematic Universe that sees Happy Hogan watching the Downton Abbey movie, because we all remember from Iron Man 3 how much he loves his Downton.
I do remember that.
Yeah. All right, so we must move on. It's time to go Galaxy Brain as we take a trip to the stars with Ad Astra. Sam, what is this film about? What isn't it about?
Yeah, Ad Astra. This is James Gray's follow-up to The Lost City of Zed. It stars Brad Pitt as astronaut Roy McBride, who goes on a top-secret mission through space to find his father, also an astronaut who went missing on a mission many years ago. And his journey will uncover secrets that challenge the nature of human existence and our place in the cosmos.
That sounds like good stuff to me. Yeah.
It's such a good premise.
Yeah.
Like, I remember hearing this like 2 years ago and thinking, why has no one done this film before? Because it sounds so good. It's so simple and straightforward.
Well, it's just Apocalypse Now.
Yeah. Why has no one done that before? Yeah.
And what a director to do it as well. I think given that pitch that we just heard, that, let's say that's the one-liner of this film, coming off the back of a film like Lost City of Zed, which certainly has similar vibes to Apocalypse Now and the sins of the fathers informing their sons, that just got me very excited about this based on what James Gray has done before.
Yeah, I mean, I was exactly the same. As soon as I heard that, I was in. I think I hyped this movie so much in my own head because I was just expecting something. Maybe I was expecting something that we haven't seen before to a degree that is just unfair. But I'm a big fan of Apocalypse Now. I'm a big fan of, like, my favourite film ever is 2001. I love Interstellar, Gravity, despite all their flaws. The expectations were supercharged, supercharged. Probably the most I've had it in a long time.
I think, well, we did our bit a couple of months ago about most anticipated films for the rest of the year, and this was my top for that. And James Gray is such an interesting director. He's one of these guys that somehow has had a 30-year career, not made that many films, and none of them make money. Mm-hmm. And he's just hit a point where he managed to convince people to give him $85 million to make his arty blockbuster with Brad Pitt. And I'm very glad that he did it. And Sam, you got to talk to him all about that.
I did, yeah. So we spoke about casting Brad Pitt. We spoke about the fact that $85 million is now considered mid-budget for this kind of film. We spoke about, like, getting the balance between, like, scientific plausibility in space, but also capturing the unknown quantity of space and the stuff that you still want to be unknown and kind of magical in space. And as you'll hear, he's a very, very intelligent guy.
And he's dosed up on paracetamol.
And he's dosed up on paracetamol because he's very jet-lagged.
All right, so do enjoy Sam with James Gray.
We're delighted to welcome James Gray to the Curzon Film Podcast. Thank you
Hello.
Very much for being here.
No, thank you for having me.
So we're here to talk about Ad Astra, which just had a very well-received premiere at Venice.
Thank God. Rather nerve-wracking.
I can imagine. I wanted to start by asking about this comparison that a lot of people have been giving the film, and that's with, like, Heart of Darkness and Apocalypse Now. So is that something that you were very conscious of when you first thought of the story for this film, or is that something that people have just started applying post-fact?
The initial spark for the story, it's funny how all things tend to sort of lead to each other. The original spark was to try and do, this very pretentious, but I was trying to do the Odyssey from Telemachus's point of view. Mm-hmm. I mean, it ends very differently, obviously, but we were trying to do a kind of mythic story, very simple, almost relying on Joseph Campbell, you know, the hero with 1,000 faces. And then you realize it became very Apocalypse Now-like because, one, the son pursuing the father is a very Conradian, you know, Marlowe pursuing Kurtz, or Willard in the movie pursuing Kurtz. And how much Francis Coppola and George Lucas were involved and interested in Joseph Campbell and the idea of myth in the late 1960s. In fact, George Lucas, who's often spoken of his debt to Joseph Campbell and to myth, himself was supposed to direct Apocalypse Now originally, and they were going to make it in 16mm in Vietnam. And John Milius, who wrote the script, he was very careful to be very kind of specific and mythic about the creation of it. So I did steal from Apocalypse Now, but only by way of trying to be mythic.
Right, right. And I think what's really interesting is that there have been a few space films that I can think of that deal with a kind of parent-child relationship at the forefront. So, like, Interstellar, I'm thinking of, or Contact, or even kind of Gravity in a certain way. Why do you think people choose to tell these stories against that background, and why did you?
Well, it's a very good question, but my own answer would be, well, first I would say I'm not exactly sure what motivated those other movies. I'm quite close to Chris Nolan. I love him dearly, but he's not only tight-lipped with the rest of the world about his films, he's tight-lipped even with his friends. The short answer that I would give you is that when you're trying to tell a very intimate story, a personal story, it's almost like you're intentionally looking for the contrast in order to make it clear. And you cannot get a greater contrast to intimacy than to the deepest part of the solar system. Mm. It's almost like you have to travel that far to become that interior, that intimate. It's a wonderful contrast. Now, there are great films, of course, made in intimate fashion. Mm-hmm. John Cassavetes's A Woman Under the Influence, for example, comes to mind. It's a masterpiece. And the landscape of the soul is covered brilliantly in the film. But Obviously, there we were trying to look outward to look inward. Mm. And I think that's probably the reason. Mm. When you face the void, you have nothing to look at except for inside.
Yeah. And there's definitely a comparison, I think, to Lost City of Z, where you have
that's true
leading with characters who are explorers and have like dedicated their life to like the pursuit of exploration and discovery, and like how that takes a toll on their lives. Was that something that you kind of got more interested in with Lost City of Z and carried over to this film?
Originally, it wasn't conscious. Right. I had written the script in 2011 for this mm-hmm. film. But you can't run away from your unconscious mind, you know. And I had made that film. You make the film when you get the money to make it. And I had made that film already. And in some ways, this became the flip side of that. Mm. That was a focus on Percy Fawcett, or at least a version of Percy Fawcett. It was not really the facts of Percy Fawcett. It's not a documentary. And ultimately, how he reunited with his son through this kind of attempt to find the sublime. And here, it's the son's search for the father. It's really focusing on the son. And for me, that was a very powerful story, too. Because ultimately, there are reasons we explore, and some of them are quite beautiful, but a lot of times we have to come to grips with the fact that exploration is either done for mercenary reasons or to escape the problems of our own world or to not focus on the problems of our own world. It would be hard to make a case, for example, that the conquistadors went to the Americas for benevolent reasons. They enslaved the population and looked for gold. And I just feel that this is a very kind of beautiful but also ugly motive. And when it's father and son, when that's involved, it's a whole other level to the drama, because we're always questioning our parents' motives.
So in terms of the look and design of the film then, it seems like there's sort of a tension when you're making a film set in space and about space travel, where you kind of want to ground it in as much reality as possible, that these are things that are believable that could happen, but you also want to keep that sort of otherworldly, you know, the beauty of space. Can you talk about walking the line between those two aspects?
It's a wonderful question, and it's not easy, because you always say to yourself, am I going to get this wrong? And you will. There's going to be one person at the very least, and you have to know this going in, who's going to watch your movie and go, that could never happen, even if it happened.
Yeah.
You know, if I made a film, I'll give you a perfect example about how difficult this kind of balance is. If you made a film about Theodore Roosevelt, mm-hmm. and I told you a story in which an assassin, a would-be assassin, went up to Theodore Roosevelt and shot him, and the bullet lodged in the papers of his speech, which he had folded in his pocket minutes before, you would watch the film, if you didn't know it was Theodore Roosevelt, and think it was totally implausible, and how could the filmmaker be so stupid as to try and make the case that that could happen? Well, in fact, it actually did happen. So real life is actually not even plausible in a movie sometimes. The movie has to establish its own reality. That is a daunting proposition. So what we tried to do is not say, what is realistic? We tried to say, what is plausible? Is the science plausible? Now, of course, there's no way for us to get to Neptune in 80 days. It's 2.7 billion miles away. But is there a form of propulsion that's on the table in the next 50 to 100 years that could maybe do it? Yeah. There's certain kinds of nuclear fusion propulsion that's under research. There's, well, ion propulsion already exists, but some form of plasma propulsion, perhaps. So you have to say, is this plausible? And then you have to ask the audience to be willing to go with you on that and just say it's the near future, you have to accept it. And I'm sure some people will not.
And something that I found quite interesting about this film is the fact that it is not based on anything. You know, it is your original screenplay. How, and it looks like it has a large budget. How, what's the process like of convincing a studio in this day and age to let you make this kind of film without relying on like a property?
It's extremely difficult, and I would not have been able to do it were it not for Brad Pitt, but also the courage, really, of Arnon and Yariv Milchan, who were the people who run New Regency. That's the sort of boutique studio that made the film. It was not made by, you know, Fox or Disney or something. It was the smaller company that did it, and the courage they had to do it. And the way, first of all, I'm glad you think it looks so large. In current budgetary terms, it's sort of middle budget. I mean, movies cost $300, $400 million now. So it's a risk, I guess, but it's not like, you know, going to bring down the studio. You know, it's not like one of those where it's like $400 million. You know, you think about this. I was discussing this the other day with a friend of mine. Cleopatra, with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, was $50 million in 1962 and 63. That's like spending $700 million today on your movie. So the economics have always been kind of wonky about the movie business. You just have to go in as passionate as you can be, express yourself about what you think the beauty of these sequences will be, express how your belief in its magical pull. And if you believe it, maybe they will too, and they'll give you the chance. And also, having Brad so passionate and committed was a great help in getting it made.
When did Brad get involved?
You forget these things. Well, it was the actual day. It was, I want to say, November of 2016, maybe a little earlier, October of 2016. That sounds about right. It was a long time ago. It was right around the election of our current president, Mr. Trump. So I would say that was November of 2016, and I think he read it and said, let's do this. And then I had decided to try and go ahead with the movie right around that point, because I was I had finished Lost City of Zed, and I had been in the jungle for a while, and I was pretty exhausted. And Brad had seen that film and really loved it. He was one of the producers. And then when it was finished, he said, oh, I love this. What do you want to do next? And I said, well, I think I might do this. And that's how it started.
Amazing. James Gray, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Okay, so let's dive straight in. I actually want to start this whole thing with the title card of the film. I'm sorry that I want to start there, but it's really interesting, and I think it's a guide for the film as well, because it's not like any space title card that we've seen before. It's big, it's red, it's serif-y, it's classical. To me, it's earthy, you know? It feels like a font that would be more akin to Victor Hugo or Barry Lyndon than it would be for space. This isn't like your clean white circles of 2001 and Alien. And I think that's because this film, as much as it is about space, it's about Earth as well, and our position within the universe and our position as people, and our in relation to the kind of, I don't know, the solar system of people around us.
Yeah, 100% agree. I think people are going to compare this to Interstellar a lot, and rightly so. There's definitely some similarities between this and Interstellar. But I think Interstellar is very much about why we need
space exploration and why it's a good thing and how space exploration can save the world. This is far more sort of contemplative and sad, and about how, look at all we've achieved in space and all mankind has achieved over these, whenever this film is set, over 100 years of like space travel, finding the big answers. And I won't say what those big answers are, but when we do find a big answer, we're sort of forced to turn around and look back at what we've left behind and what it's cost us to get to this big moment, and how there's a kind of indescribable feeling of loneliness when you come to that big answer and realise what it's cost you.
Mm. Yeah, it's a big boy film. Stefan, a nice follow-up to Lost City of Zed. Like, we kind of take it, we mentioned that like thematically there's certainly stuff there, but I think James Gray, given that extra money, manages to kind of take on technique and ideas that he really hasn't had the chance to do so before, and it is just exciting to watch that on the big screen.
Yeah, definitely. And I think just thinking about this, like, really appreciate the kind of chronological, like, linear narrative style of both of those films. And I think when you're tackling like big themes and big questions and stuff, sometimes it probably helps just to have a simply laid out film. I think like what I liked so much about Lost City of Zed was that kind of, you've just got this all in order film, and it's like a little bit repetitive, but by the end of it, you feel like you've come out with something.
Well, you've lived with it.
Yeah. And you're not. And I think sometimes with space as well, it can be quite tempting for films to just mess around with time, mess around with the order that they're putting things in. But I think, yeah, I really appreciated this just being kind of all laid out quite simply. And then you can draw from that.
Yeah, I think he refers to himself as a classical filmmaker. Like, he is like locking a lot of shots off and letting them play out. And he came up in that new Hollywood school, and everyone's Tarantino, everyone wants to pick up the camera like Scorsese and Goodfellas and rush around and follow everyone and throw people into a film like that and throw people into its atmosphere by literally pushing audiences into it like that. And he's not interested in that. He wants to build that world around you gradually as well. Like, this opens with a pretty incredible set piece, but it is also quite quiet. Like, we've got this giant antenna poking out the sky and Brad Pitt holding onto the side of it and falling and crashing down to Earth. But it reminded me of the opening of First Man as well, yeah, where you've got that high-intensity event with this guy in the helmet and a true American hero. But what you get here, and I suppose in First Man as well, is like this is quieter, this is more reflective, this is a more somber characterization of that true American hero. But this does not have like Kip Thorne on scientific accuracy duty, like taking a like fine comb through the script to get exactly all the right details from NASA. This is having a bit more fun with the idea of the sci-fi film.
Yeah, I think it's like, certainly by the end, without spoiling anything, there's bits, and it's definitely meant to be this kind of dreamlike, you're more in a 2001 area kind of thing, where everything's got a more material and tactile feel to it than 2001, but it's meant to have that metaphorical kind of journey of the id, of the ego and everything towards the end, because there's a scene where he's very much saying, like, it's almost put there to annoy the Kip Thorns, the Neil deGrasse Tysons, who'll get on Twitter and point out, you know, the inaccuracies. And maybe that were fairer criticisms, stuff like Interstellar and Gravity, that were trying to say we're doing everything right. So then there's some little bits they got to pick up. And this, definitely at the end, there's a thing where he takes like a panel off of without giving too much away, a panel that is almost getting into comic book territory. It's like, this is, we are going for something completely different.
It totally works though, doesn't it?
It worked for me, yeah. I'm someone that's never really questioned the realism of like a space film though.
No.
It's never ever bothered me once.
No, not at all. And it's interesting that we've mentioned Stella so much because it's Hoyt van Hoytema, who is the cinematographer on that film, has returned to the vacuum of space once again for this one. And what is really interesting is that you do not notice that it's the same guy. Like, I would be fascinated to hear the conversations that him and James Gray had about what is the visual identity of this film going to be, and how do we make sure that we're not just mimicking what you've done before? Because Interstellar is huge, it's grand, and this is more experimental for sure. I know that like they did a lot of odd things, like shooting at 6 frames per second and getting Brad Pitt to move really slowly.
Oh, wow.
And then sped it up so that it would get the effect of like a spacewalk.
Right.
And so like even on this budget and this intensity, they're still being like, should we just like play around for a bit?
Yeah.
Which is great to see.
Does anyone know, was it shot digitally?
No, it was on film.
It was on film. Because when I saw it, I was thinking how clean it looked. Mm. And I was thinking, that was obviously me making it up. I was just like, this is what I imagine space to look like. But I was thinking it had this super clean, crisp feel to it.
Yeah. Mm. There's so many textures as well. Like, there's the bit where they're driving along and he puts his hand up and there's all kind of moon dust on his hand. And I feel like it. Sometimes I feel like with space films, you just get blackness and you don't really feel like you feel anything. But this, like, there's so many things that you feel like you could touch out, like reach out and touch.
Absolutely. And if you want to reach out and touch it, it's in cinemas now. Actually, it's not, because we're doing this episode a week early so that we could fit in 2 more films next week. It's actually out on Wednesday, isn't it?
It's out on Wednesday.
Yes. So do go and watch that when you can. Like, if you are a fan of former classic space dad films, like Close Encounters and Contact and Interstellar and anything like that, do check this one out. But also, if you're like fans of Apocalypse Now, for sure, do go check this one. Also, James Gray is such an interesting director, and like, I just wish him success. So just go and watch it for him, you know. So if you need to fill your time between now and the film coming out on Wednesday, you could always watch something on Curzon Home Cinema, couldn't you?
You can. You can watch Long Shot, the romantic comedy starring Seth Rogen and Charlize Theron, which is a lot of fun.
Didn't realise that was written by Liz Hannah, who wrote The Post.
Yeah. Really weird.
Yeah, but great.
And then from Monday, you can finally catch up with John Wick, Chapter 3, Parabellum.
And
it's an annoying title.
It is. But that's a
great film. And we spoke about that on the podcast when it came out.
Yeah, we did. Mark, you were on for that.
I was.
Yeah, we had a good time.
Talking about action.
Yes.
A lot of action.
A lot of killing in that one. Lots. You want to see a man kill another man with a book? That's the film.
He does kill someone with a book.
Along with Downton Abbey, of course. And if you've got any thoughts on Downton Abbey or Ad Astra, do let us know. You can tweet us at Curzon Cinemas. And you can also just keep in touch with us as well. I'm on Twitter at Jake H. Cunningham. Sam, you're there.
At SamHowlett_1.
Mark?
My Twitter's like as desolate as space. I hardly ever tweet. So if you want to follow someone that's just a silence in the abyss, it's Mark at Mark D. Towers.
Mark's Twitter went to space to find my Twitter. Found nothing.
Steph, you are tweeting. You're not just like sending out signals that aren't bouncing back.
It's all Downton Abbey content from now on. That's _StephWatts.
Lovely stuff. All right. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. If it's your first time listening to the show, subscribe on iTunes, Acast, wherever you get your pods, and leave us a review while you're there. That'd be lovely. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that.
Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.